Welcome to Just Now Possible with Teresa Torres.
My name is Sina. I'm the CPO here at Nepo. So I'm responsible for the product team, the tech team, and also the customer team. My background is mainly in maths and psychology, and I've been in various startups for quite a few years and have been at Nepo now for around a year and a bit.
I'm CTO. I'm one of the four co-founders of Nepo, so been with the company the longest, which is almost 3 years now. We've had to invent and reinvent ourselves with all of the inventions that have happened in AI. And it's been an amazing journey.
It's never a boring day.
It is never a boring day.
And I'm Christos. I've been with the company the shortest, just closing in 3 months. I'm the lead design engineer. It's a bit of a hybrid role, so my responsibilities are in the UI UX and also implementing it in the front-end side of things. And of course, user research and everything that comes with it. And I have a background in creative technology and in freelancing and a bit of art installations. My background is mixed in design and stuff that I like to do on the side. And now I'm at Nepo. And yeah, super happy to be here and be having an impact on the field of AI.
Excellent. Let's dig in. Who wants to tell me about your product?
So what we are doing at Nepo is we are providing our customers with what we call digital co-workers. And what that basically translates to is AI agents, but really built for the people rather than for the AI. And so our focus really is on making AI as accessible as possible. Our core customer base is heavily focused around customer success, customer service, especially with a focus on e-commerce all across Europe. And yeah, we now have been around for about 3 years and have 200-ish customers that we are working with. And yeah, that in a nutshell.
Yeah, great. And I looked around on your website. It looks like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it looks like you have AI agents, almost like an intercom thin that is like working on behalf of your customers. But it also looks like maybe there's a platform behind it where your customers can define like custom workflows. Can you explain a little bit about how that works?
Absolutely. So the way that we approach our product and the way that we approach also solving the problem that we're solving is really customer first and user first. So everything that we build, our customer is also able to add themselves, change themselves, and really create their coworker that works for them in their processes and their workflows rather than just something out of the box that they don't have to ask us to make changes to, but really with the angle of making it actually accessible for them and not a black box.
Yeah, I got the vibe as it feels a little bit similar to Devin. Have any of you played with Devin, the designed to be like the engineer on your team? Yeah, it seems like a little bit similar, but maybe for our non-technical coworkers to have a Devin. Is that fair?
Exactly. Yeah, I think that is very fair with exactly the differentiation for the non-technical co-workers and also enabling people that rarely ever touch anything technical, don't necessarily know what an API is or what connecting a system really means, to still be able to do that without having to wait for their tech team to actually action that.
Tell me a little bit about the origin story. Where did this idea come from? What was, I know, Sena, you started to make AI more accessible. Was that kind of the root, the seed that started this?
Yeah, I'll take this one as the co-founder. I was actually graduating. So I had a previous company before and I was actually graduating. And during that time, the research preview of ChatGPT came out. And the thing that we now know as ChatGPT, that was just shy of 2 years before ChatGPT actually came out. And I very vividly remember that I was interacting with it. And I thought, this is really a turning point to some extent in technology, that instead of you always needing to change and adapt your own ways of working to what your computer expects, this is finally a moment in time where you can have your computer adapt to you. And that is really where it all started. And that is really why we make this a Nepo, why we turn it into a character with a face, with a name, with a personality, to really embody this kind of new world that we now live in.
Yeah, I love this. The podcast is called Just Now Possible because so many of these stories start with this new technology came out and this thing we've always had a vision of is just now possible. And I also love this idea that it's a Meeple. Let's get into that a little bit. It's like you're creating, this is why I equated it to Devin. You're creating essentially AI coworkers.
Exactly. I think for us, what we really noticed with our customers as well is that AI is still scary for a lot of them, especially if you're in a non-technical role. You do have kind of a lot of apprehension to maybe starting. You see a lot of things online on what AI can do, but also where it may be going wrong, or also, of course, the ever-recurring topic of, is it going to take my job? And so for us, really, the focus and also the turning point in the direction that we went with was to really understand, okay, how can we make it, how can we create that human connection with the product that we are providing while still keeping that barrier, of course, as well. There is, of course, a layer too far that you could go in theory, but really giving people something that they can connect with and that actually resonates with them. And so for a lot of our customers, actually, at this point, they're in Meeple. They all have their own name, they have their own design, they have their own company branding of the company that they're working for. And a lot of our customers also in their HQ have a full-size cutout of their Meeple standing in their office, which is always quite nice to see when I go and visit customers. But for a lot of them, their Meeple is really what AI is. So that's what they identify with AI at this point, because that was their entry point to really working with AI and finding a way to sustainably work with it as well.
Okay, yeah. So let's get really specific. It sounds like a lot of your customers are in retail, are like e-commerce. So let's imagine that I have an e-commerce company. It looks like you're very heavily based in the EU, which I love. And I'm an EU e-commerce company. I need help on my team. What are the types of things that my Meeple might do for me?
Yeah, really depends on what it is that you need. But what the Meeple, or what most of our Meeple especially focus on, really is, yeah, on the customer service layer, for example. So enabling agents to actually focus on the complex cases and really taking away the repetitive work. So may that be things like responding to very straightforward tickets, or also performing things like actions and systems and doing things on behalf of our customers as well. What we really see as the most important thing in work is to enable people to have joy in their work. And joy usually doesn't come from the repetitive work that you're constantly doing and it's just the same thing all over. I think if any of us were working in customer success, none of us would want to answer the same question 20 times in a day, realistically speaking. And so that's really what we're trying to achieve here for our customers, is to give them the joy back in their work and to take out the repetitive work that also doesn't necessarily really engage them from a like mental load perspective as well.
Yeah, I often have to answer the same question 20 times. So that definitely resonates with me.
For a Meeple for you then.
Yeah. Okay, I want to go back to something you said. You said it allows the agent to handle the most complex cases. And you meant the human agent. Like the Meeple, yes, is handling the repetitive, like common questions that come up so that the human customer success agent can focus on the more complex cases.
Exactly.
And it's based on your framing of this, it sounds like your Meeple is an agent. Like it is responding to kind of customer success tickets on its own.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And then are there other things besides customer support emails that the Meeple does?
Yeah. So the way that we approach Meeple is that for a lot of our customers, kind of customer service was the entry point, because that's usually where most of the repetitive work in a company lies. And also, those are usually teams that deal with a lot of high volumes, high pressure, and are kind of, for a lot of companies, the burning fire, I would say, what we see. But the way that we approach the product and the way that we're also focusing allows our customers to also utilize Meeple beyond the customer success or customer service case as well. So our customers are also able to, for example, use it in operational processes, anything that is a process really, or a workflow that happens on a repetitive basis, our Meeple is able to help them with as well.
Do you have some examples of what those might be?
Yeah, some examples would, for example, be things like invoice reconciliation. So in finance, rather than having to go and sort all of your invoices every month that come in, maybe in 5 different inboxes, depending on your company, Meeple can go ahead and do that for you on behalf of you. Also let you know what invoices are still open, for example. You can also do your like personal things as well. Like, for example, meeting summaries, action points from a meeting, sending out reminders to people on open action items, which I, for example, use it for quite a lot. I have a lot of meetings usually. And yeah, providing email drafts, for example, as well, if you just want to like reduce a bit of your mental load, or also other operational use cases as well. But I think those would be some examples.
The most fun examples are the examples that your customers come up with and not yourself, right? So one of the examples that I really love, one of our customers, they started with Anipal, and I think within a few weeks or within a few months, their entire marketing department was using the Anipal also to write, because in the end, like in customer support, customer service, tone of voice is really important. So we really spend a lot of time to get the tone of voice of the Anipal right, to pretty much make the Anipal the company personified to some extent. And that is, of course, what the marketing team also loves. So they were drafting new blog posts and they were drafting new headers constantly with their Anipal. And I think that's just a really cool use case also.
There's so much to dig into here, but I want to clarify. It sounds like you have a workflow builder that your customers can use. Is it fair to think about that like a Zapier or a Make or an 8N, but like for your Anipal?
Yes and no. I think with most workflow builders, you do need to have some understanding of what input to give to get the right outputs. So for example, in 8N, if you use it for the first time, you usually ask, hey, how familiar are you with API keys, as an example? And that's something that for a lot of people is already quite a barrier of entry, because if you have never looked at an API key or worked in any sort of technical related field, you're going to struggle with that. So our focus really is on the conversational aspect as well.
If you think about it like a code, we are building more like something like Scratch instead of something like a C++, something like for people that are just getting into it, just want to learn how to use those exciting tools, but at the same time, not be overwhelming and just guide them to do the stuff they want to do while learning a bit and not just giving everything all at once and overwhelm them and ending up with them not doing anything.
So one of the things I love about what you've shared is it sounds like there's so many aspects of your Anipal. Like it can act as an agent and respond to support emails. Your customers can create these custom workflows. And so it's maybe there's some agentic pieces to that, but it also maybe like very fixed workflows. You mentioned writing with the Anipal. Let's go back to the very early days. How did you prototype some of this stuff? How did you know that any of this would be possible?
If I look at the very early days, a lot of this wasn't possible. Yeah. When we did our short pre-discussion, like there's a lot of companies that are figuring out how to work with AI. And I think over the past 2.5-3 years of existing, we've constantly figured out how to work with AI. I think we've reinvented ourselves 5 times over.
Okay.
Because large language models keep reinventing themselves. And when we first started, like a lot wasn't possible. So all of this workflow stuff wasn't possible. Sending out automated answers just wasn't reliable enough. Like it wasn't even reliable enough to just have a chat conversation. Chat models didn't exist when we started. So we had our first Anipal sometimes just complete the entire conversation also on my behalf. So we started off very basic with just suggestions in a contact center. There is the place where a lot of questions happen, and we knew we weren't reliable enough at that point to send out actual answers. We knew we couldn't give the quality we wanted to give to our users. So it started off with suggestions, and we started off integrating with more and more services and with more and more apps. And then slowly but surely, our product evolved, large language models evolved, and now we're here today. And now virtually everything is possible. But it really started with almost nothing.
So originally it was giving suggestions to a customer success agent for like how to respond to something?
Exactly, yes.
Okay. And then you said lots of integrations. Are you integrating into like support ticket software, maybe Slack? Is that the idea of like they can get a suggestion from their Anipal in any of the places they might be interacting with customers?
Yeah, we basically integrate into customers' contact centers, for example, but also into their chat apps, because some of our customers also like to just get some input from the Nepo here and there. But we also integrate with the other systems that customers are using that might be relevant to actually either provide a suggestion or automation or do any of the workflows. And that can be anything from, in the CS case, an OMS system, or in the finance case, their finance tool, HR software. I think the list is endless when it comes to those. And also, of course, anything where you store knowledge in. So anything that might be relevant for your Nepo to actually provide the work or do the work that you're asking it to do. So yeah, we're integrating into a very wide range of systems by now.
Yeah, one of the things that jumps out at me about your product is there's so much landscape to cover. And I'm curious about if you started in this space of we're going to make suggestions to a customer support agent, how did this evolve over time? What do you have the highlights of how it evolved over time?
Yeah, I think from a highlights perspective, very high level, that would be definitely going from suggestions to then going to automation. So having responses reliable enough that also our customers were confident with the Nepo just sending out responses on behalf of them, to then going to action. So also working on tickets that actually require the human agent to do something, may that be like canceling an order or changing a shipping address. So very standard CS use cases, to then going beyond that also into other systems and doing use cases there. So those, I think, were really the four milestones per se in this journey. And it's quite interesting to look at, because the milestone length became shorter and shorter over time. Mm. So the suggestions timeframe, I think, was overall almost 2 years. Whereas then from the automation to the actions to actions beyond CS, timeframe was very small in comparison.
Yeah, that's what's so fun about this space. One, the models are getting a lot better. But two, I think as we learn how to build this way, that second product, third product, they just get better and better, which is, it's really fun to see. I'm seeing this from a lot of teams.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the upsides, one of the downsides at the start, was that customer support is the interface between all of your internal tools and the outside world. And that was, to be fair, quite annoying at the start, because to give a good suggestion, you needed to integrate with 10 different systems.
Yeah.
And every customer has 10 of their own systems. So that required us to build a lot of integrations, but that also made the follow-up steps a lot easier, because we already integrated with all of these systems and we already had all this information. So why not branch to a different department, to different people, and also make them interact with the Nepo?
Yeah, the first thought that went through my head was, and you did all this, I'm guessing, before MCP. And then the second thought that went through my head was, what a great asset that starts to compound over time. You've started to integrate with companies' tools, and so now you can expand within the organization. How did you decide which products to integrate with?
Yeah, that was we had a very core belief when we started, and that is this digital colleague. And it, to be fair, sometimes it happens, but usually it doesn't happen, that a new colleague starts and they say, oh, I don't support Teams, I only support Slack. Yeah. That's not something a human would say. Yes, they prefer Slack maybe, but they do support Teams still. And that is what we called work where you work. So the Nepo really works where you work. And that really means that we let our customers decide what we needed to integrate with. We really figured out, okay, what tools do you use? Where is the value for you? And then went from there, because we really weren't going to say, okay, the Nepo just doesn't work where you work. If you switch to system XYZ, then you might get the full value out of your Nepo. But that's not how human colleagues work. So that's also, in our belief, not how digital colleagues should work.
This feels like an infinite problem, though. I could have 5 customers with, there may be overlap in their tech stack, but they're all unique.
Correct, correct.
And it is definitely something that, from a scaling perspective, also is, of course, only manageable to a certain extent. So We do by now also work with an external party for integrations as well. So we're using another startup there, which makes that loop a lot easier for our customers. And in addition to that, we also work with browser use. So for systems that are not just very easily accessible via API, our customers also can utilize browser use and access the information that they need or do the things that they need to do via the front end. I think browsing is one of those topics that I think a lot of people have very different opinions on how good it is, but it is constantly evolving, which really helps. I think over the last half year, we've probably had about 12, 13 iterations, just versioning wise, that were significantly better than each of the ones before. So we also allow customers to really take that into their own hands as well and not be reliant on any capacity from integration perspective of our partner, but be able to just work where they work from the get-go.
I love this. I love that it's now possible to take what feels like an infinite problem and actually start to chip away at it. So that's amazing. Let's start with the suggestions piece. How did this evolve? Give me a sense of, from an AI architecture standpoint, how does the suggestions work and how are you doing this for a bunch of different companies?
I'll give you a tiny bit of history and then I'll tell you how it is now. So when we started off, we thought, okay, large language models are going to solve all the problems in the world and all of the problems in our product. So we just had one humongous prompt. Back then, context windows were, I think, 2K at max. By now, there's, I think I saw this morning, so a 100 million context window model pop up. But back then, 2K was all we had. We just crammed it full and just hoped that it would give a good suggestion. Then we went through a very quick phase of, okay, LLMs are just making our problems bigger. So we reverted to just writing as much code as possible and as little LLM interactions as possible just to get consistency. And I think now we're at a phase where I would say we've always had some kind of agent, but now we're doing it the proper agentic way. I've seen traces where with workflows that went on for well over an hour of just the Nepal going on an adventure through someone's Google Drive to clean it up. And now it is just a lot of agents. There's still a bit of a fixed flow in there because we just need the safety. We need the guardrails. We need the evaluations to really make sure that what we put out and what we do is actually good. So there is still a relatively fixed sequence, but within those steps, there's a lot of agents collaborating to really get the best results that we can.
Yeah. Okay. I want to unpack this a little bit. So you started with, you even told me the origin of the story of the company is LLMs are making this just now possible. Let's go in this realm. And then you went through this phase of LLMs are terrible. Let's go back to writing code. Did you fall back to just search in that code phase?
We never went back to full search. So we always had some reg in there.
Okay.
But we went through so many iterations and so many things. And I think one of the first problems that we solved or that we had to solve was turn-based conversations.
Yeah.
That was where we started. And I said, then the only thing that was feasible back then was suggestions. And now we're living in such a different world.
Yeah. And what's funny is the reason why I asked because you fall back to search is we start with this idea, living in an LLM world, it's so easy to think about, oh, of course the LLM can make suggestions and help me do my job better. It turns out design search could have always done that as well. But knowing LLMs exist encourages us to tackle problems we wouldn't otherwise tackle, which is fun to see how it just opens up the opportunity space for us.
Yeah. Okay, I think one of the most important things is that a lot of people really hate or dislike chatbots because they are based in search. And that's something that we really never wanted to go near because it is such a different quote unquote entity that we knew we always needed to have the power and the empathy and the personality to some extent of a language model in there.
Yeah.
So we wanted to steer away from that.
Okay, so it sounds like today suggestions, from what you described, it sounds like maybe multiple agentic steps, but maybe still on guardrails or still as a workflow with agentic components. Is that fair?
Yeah, that is definitely fair.
Okay, can you share a little bit about that? You don't have to give me like secret sauce details, but I'd love just the high level architecture. Like, how are you thinking through how to define those guardrails? How are you thinking through what's a deterministic part of the workflow versus where do you give it a little more freedom?
Yeah, let's take you through it, or let's try to at least.
Yeah.
So in the end, everything starts with a ticket coming. So a ticket comes in, and usually that's just a ticket number. We don't really know what to do with a ticket. We try to gather, okay, what is on with this ticket? And I'm just for the sake of clarity, I'm talking about specifically like answering a ticket use case. Of course, there's all these actions. But so in the context of answering a ticket comes in, we gather all the ticket information. We know we always need to do that. So that is just code. There's no reason to involve large language models there because we know that we need to gather all this information.
I'm assuming that's like information about the customer, maybe the order of the tickets and like all that sort of supplemental info.
Yes, everything, the tags to a ticket, the assignee to a ticket, everything that could help answer the ticket.
Okay.
Then we go on one hand into our knowledge base. And our knowledge base is currently a vector database. And that also went through multiple different iterations. But the most important thing is currently there's pretty much an agent that has a sole responsibility to find the right information from the knowledge base. Yeah. So the knowledge base can contain product feeds, can contain websites, can contain anything pretty much. And we give this agent just the freedom to find the right information. And they have different tools for semantic search, for keyword search, for a combination of both. And it just has a task to find the right information.
And is that agent getting all of the context that you just pulled in around the ticket?
It is getting all of the context that we pulled in because a lot of different customers have a lot of different setups.
Okay.
And some might store really relevant information in a ticket field. Some might store it only in the conversation. So it can be anywhere.
Okay. So that even that just agent has some complexity of understanding what in my knowledge base might be related to all this different context that's been added to this support ticket.
Exactly.
Okay.
To continue the journey from there, then we check any external system. So that can be an order management system, a warehouse management system. That can be, like Sena just said, a system that is connected through browser use. Which then again is another agent just having its own tiny Chrome browser that just goes on an adventure from there. Then with all of this information gathered, we try to give the perfect answer. And that can consist of policies, that can consist of any internal and external document that we've been able to find. And then one of the most important steps I would say happens, which is evaluation. Because if we're going to be talking externally to a customer's customer, we really need to make sure that what we're doing is correct. So there is, I think, almost half of the large language model interactions and LLM calls that we do are just simply evaluations. Is there a hallucination in there? Is there some implied action that we haven't taken? Is there some order in here? Is there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And is that happening in the production run before you respond to the customer?
Yes.
Okay.
Always 100% of the time.
Yeah.
Because we need it to be correct. And then if all checks are passed, we send it out. If none of the checks or not all of the checks have passed, we still provide a suggestion because we know those can still be helpful. But
a suggestion to the human customer.
Correct.
Agent.
So an internal note that says, I wasn't 100% able to verify this message. I think it's still valuable for you, but please check it before you send it.
And how is that determined?
That is simply because from all the evals. So if we detect that something is not 100% grounded in the knowledge that we have, we don't send it out. if we detect that the Nepal has implied taking an action that it didn't actually do, it's not going to be sent out. And there's a lot of different checks and balances that we add there to really make sure that we can adhere to the quality that our customers expect from us.
Yeah. Okay. This is great because I can imagine how each of these steps works, but the collection leads to some pretty complex behavior, which is great. Like this I feel is a lot of the magic of LLM workflows. Okay. I'm just trying to imagine how this evolved over time, and tell me about the decision to shift from suggestions internally to customer service agents. I guess they're not your customer service agents. Suggestions to your customers' customer service agents versus having the confidence to say, no, this agent can just respond.
I think a lot of that was very heavily influenced by our customers' reflections and customer feedback. So at the time where we started with the suggestions only, our customers were obviously giving a lot of feedback, and there's also a process in place on those suggestions to give direct feedback. So we had a very good understanding of what's going well, what's not going well. It was a very clear distinction between the very complex workflows, where usually the suggestions would go semi-well, I would say, and the repetitive workflows where the suggestions were quite, confident, I would say, and the customers were quite happy with it. And then one day, Job built a really random feature overnight, basically, which was to add to those suggestions for all of the contact centers to add two buttons, which were basically just, one was copy message so that the customer could copy the full message and send that out straight away. And the second one was send straight to customer, which basically gave the agent the ability to just automate it, but having that really tiny final human check just in case they wanted to. And it was like one of those things that, you're literally, I think, on a Friday evening. And then we put into production for our customers and started monitoring, of course, from a data perspective, how our customers were using it. And we immediately saw the uptake of our customers on those repetitive workflows to just send out the responses to the customers. And so we were like, okay, great. That means clearly those are good enough for our customers to actually have the confidence. And so we sat down with our customers. We always, for every feature we release, we always go into a bit of a like alpha mode with a few customers, do research with them, test with them, prototype with them before we take something to production. So what we initially did is we ran basically all of our evals on a bunch of the tickets that had already gone through and gave them a list of the tickets that would have been automated and said, hey, just tell us if you would have been happy with this or if something is really off here. And basically got the feedback like that. Our customers were luckily very helpful on that front, very responsive to also really go through many tickets. And that allowed us to then start automating on certain topics. And we quickly saw customers had quite a big need to really be able to control what it is that goes out. For example, in a lot of our customer cases, they also get legal questions or like really important complaints through their customer service pipeline. And they don't want those to necessarily be responded to by an agent at this point in time. So we made sure that we gave our customers the right guardrails to set themselves as well, to really be able to say, okay, never automate, for example, legal questions or complaints, and then allow them to basically start automating at their own desire with the topics and documents that they really felt comfortable with. Yeah.
I also want to add, like, in the design perspective as well, we also think it's really important to actually show the customers everything, because even if the system works flawlessly, you still have to earn their trust to, like, actually have them understand what's going on and how. So yeah, that's one big point as well that we made sure to, like, throughout the process, the customers, before they enable something, they know exactly what's about to do and how, so they feel confident to have it running.
Yeah, what you're describing, there's so much I love here around an area I'm really interested in is how do we get our customers involved in the eval process? And these buttons that you added, Job, are basically a measurement from the customer. I can use this. I had to edit this, which is really amazing. And then it sounds like you took it a step farther with some of these like beta customers. They actually did the equivalent of human grading to tell you that they would have sent this or not, which is amazing. Is the equivalent of that still? I know a lot of emails are being automated, but for the ones that aren't, do you still have that kind of human feedback loop from your customers in the product?
Yeah, we do at this point in time. We definitely see quite a big pull towards the full automation and focus on that. So our customers at this point in time tend to prefer to do less topics, so maybe not 100% of the use cases for suggestions in their contact centers, but therefore deeper. So they'd rather have everything regarding orders, for example, automated than also get suggestions on legal topics, for example. But at this point in time, we do still have that human feedback loop process as well.
For the ones they send themselves.
Exactly.
This is making me curious. Okay, so I can see how over time, your customers build trust in this system. They're able to automate more topics. They're less involved in customer success. You have evals that run in your production line, which is great. But how do you know that for a given customer, the Neeple isn't drifting away from what they originally? Like, how does quality work over time for, like, in the context of a single customer?
It's a really good question. And it's also something our customers, when they start automating, also often ask, like, how do I still make sure that everything is going as I expect it to? And most of our customers, at least in the CS use case, do have some form of feedback mechanism also with their customers. So may that be CSAT scoring or just, yeah, providing feedback on a closed ticket or getting a survey. And so they are able to see, of course, how their customers are responding to the Neeple. And what some of our customers also did is specifically for tickets that the Neeple did respond to, is to implement those feedback mechanisms if they didn't have them. And then, of course, also within CS, you often have quite the standard kind of metrics, such as first response rates, resolution time, things like that. And so by the Neeple doing its job well on those repetitive workflows, the first response rates should be really high because the Neeple is working on tickets that usually require one response, some piece of information or something done and then completed. And so they see the metrics also on their end over time from, yeah, let's say maybe 10% first response rate to a 70% first response rate. And if that is negatively trending, then it's likely that there's something going wrong. But if it's positively trending, then that's usually directly correlated to the Neeple.
Yeah, I love that there's clear measurement basically all the way through the process, which is great. I could see one major limitation that could arise, and I'm curious how you overcome this. So, Yobin, the process that you described, like you have an agent that's pulling from this knowledge base. I'm assuming every customer has their own knowledge base, and the quality of the Neeple responses depends heavily on the quality of that knowledge base. So, What are you doing to make sure that I could see it very easily feeling like that's out of your hands? My customer has to create that knowledge base. But I imagine for your product to work well, you have to be involved on some level.
That is a constant topic also within our customer team, because yes, it is very much true that what you put in is also what you get out. And I think this is where the point that Christos mentioned plays in really heavily by giving customers the full visibility of the thought process that their Neeple also took to create the response. There's definitely been a lot of times before we made that as visible as we did over the last few months where our customers would reach out and say, hey, on these 20 tickets, the Neeple didn't say what I wanted it to. It's really confusing. I don't know how to fix it. And with the visibility we give them now, they really can see every single step that the Neeple is taking, from all the evals to every knowledge source it used and what it used from there.
So,
and
then our customers... You're giving your non-technical customers basically visibility, it sounds like, into the whole trace. Is that right?
Exactly. But in a way that they can understand it.
That is amazing.
And I think it's the only way really to make it actually accessible, because if there is a black box element to it, you're always going to be wondering, is there something I'm missing? And so by giving them that, they are able to really come to those conclusions themselves where they see, oh, okay, of course my Neeple can't know this because I never taught my Neeple this.
It's not in the knowledge base.
Exactly. Or I think we often have the case that customers use static knowledge instead of dynamic. And so if they update something, how would their Neeple possibly know? And then when they go on check it, which they can do down to the level of a specific ticket or specific message, they see, oh, okay, I my Meeple has information from 2023. It can't give a better answer than that. So I need to update that. And that giving that visibility has really made a whole difference for us in our collaboration with our customers and the kind of questions that they actually ask, because they do now also have the tools to take responsibility for the output that their product that they're using is creating at the end.
Okay, I want to work backwards because I think I can see how this works, and it's brilliant. So I'm a retailer. I own an e-commerce company. I'm getting a bunch of support tickets. I've set up my Meeple long enough that it's just automated. I don't have to respond to any support tickets, which is amazing. All of my support emails have a little feedback thing on it. So as my customers can tell me, did it solve their problem or not? I have my little customer support dashboard of like high CSAT score, low response time, like everything's great. Every once in a while, I get maybe like a low rating and I can go and look at what went wrong. And I can see, oh, it went wrong because I updated my prices, but I didn't update it in the knowledge base. And that gives the customer the context they need to go and fix the problem. And so in some ways, your customer's customer are the eval, right? Because they're saying, did this work or not? And your customer is able to do the error analysis and fix the problem before it even comes to you.
Exactly.
I love this because when I first learned about evals, I learned about it as like engineers grading things. And I'm like, do engineers have the domain knowledge to grade things? And then like I learned about like product managers need some technical skills to be involved. And I got really curious about like, how is this going to work in practice? Like when every product team is doing this, it crosses product, it crosses design, it crosses engineering. This is a truly collaborative work. And then like literally the next thought I had was, and it's work the customer should be doing. And I started to get curious about what are the feedback mechanisms we need to design so that customers are ultimately the eval? Because that's what matters. Did we serve the customer or not? It sounds like you've built that entirely into your product.
Yeah, I think for us, it is really at the core of also what we're trying to achieve with the product, which is really that accessibility. And I think in most cases of a product, the customer has the responsibility to really make it work in a way that gives them the most value. And so for us, by making it as simple and as digestible for them to do, that creates that loop by default. And we really see our customers also be excited to actually change things themselves. When we first launched our visible platform where they actually were able to do the things themselves and show it to a few customers and test it out with them. And I remember one specific conversation I had with a customer who was having a bit of a rough time with some of the knowledge pieces because they are in the entertainment business. So things get updated quite regularly depending on the like kind of events that are going on. And they were having a rough time with stuff from, I think, 2023 still being in there. We showed them how they were now able to just, see what's going on and B, also immediately updated. And also the Meeple then immediately applying the new knowledge on every future ticket. And they were baffled at that point and so super, super excited because it just gives them the power to really make it successful.
Yeah, this is great. Okay, there's a couple areas I want to dig into the technical details if you're open to it. It seems like one critical step is that agent that's looking for relevant knowledge from the knowledge base. So I'd love to learn a little bit more about that. And then the second area, I know you mentioned like at least half your LLM calls are for evals. So I'd love, especially in such a complex system, I'd love to get into your strategy on how you decided to do your evals. Maybe we can start with that RAG piece. You mentioned it's an agent with tools. Just give me a sense for what are you doing to make sure that's a reliable step?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's really complicated because like you said, like in the end, like we're very dependent on the quality of knowledge that our customers give to us. And we are, quote unquote, lucky that the majority of our customers is in retail, is in hospitality, is in e-commerce. And they all tend to have really good websites. So one of the first things that we built was, okay, we cannot always 100% rely on their internal knowledge because not all of our customers had that worked out to the extent that we would have liked. but we can pretty much always rely on their website because all of the product's information is there, their FAQ is there, their knowledge base is there. Everything just was there. So very quickly, we came to the conclusion that it's one of the many ways to get the right data into our systems was through their websites. And in the end, like our RAG agent, it also went through so many different iterations. First, there was semantic search. Then we uncovered that semantic search works really well if you are asking a question in the same language as the source document. Then we're like, okay, how do we solve this? So then we needed to solve that. Like the next challenge is a product feed. If the product is called O1 and the customer is asking for product O2, they're probably very similar products. And you don't want semantic search because the semantics of very similar products are very similar. So then you need to resort back to keyword search, like the old school search, let's say.
Yeah.
And so all of these things we had to discover along the way. And all of this knowledge that we accrued along the way, we eventually distilled into this agent that now has access to full semantic search, to hybrid search, to keyword search, to select different document types. So we know that some questions are probably in an FAQ-like document. Some questions can probably be answered in a product feed-like document. So it has all these parameters and all these tools and an understanding, of course, because we say, okay, these are the, let's say, 10 document types that we have. And by giving it the right understanding of A, the tools to use, and also the parameters to use these tools with, we can really help the agent help us in the end to surface the right information. And in the end, like when this agent first came to life, it was just one single call. And then we found, okay, but this single call is not necessarily good enough results-wise. So we needed to make it a loop and we needed to make it a proper agent. And now it's a proper agent that just reviews its results. And then when it's happy, it gives us the right results to be able to answer the incoming ticket.
How does it decide when it's happy?
When at some point we cut it off because this could be like an infinite loop of assistance because sometimes the knowledge is just not there. So we just give it, from top of my head, 5 turns max.
Okay.
And the happiness is defined, like in the end, it's a large language model.
Yeah.
But it has one single goal in life, and that is to answer the question, and not even to answer the question, but to provide the documents that answer the question.
Yeah.
So it is happy when it has found the right documents to answer this question.
I imagine like you can rely on some of the like recall and precision scores that like we see with RAG steps in general. But if you don't know what like it, at the, when the agent is, it sounds like, let's say if I get 5 rounds through the loop, maybe I'm comparing like one round to another round, trying to look for, is there a better document? But there's still this like open question of, I have a document that could answer the question. Is it the right document? Is it the best document? Is there something around like satisficing versus maximizing? Like, how is this agent, if it's truly agentic, I'm just really curious about like, how is it making that decision of I've got a document that we can move forward with?
Yeah, that is, in the end, we still use the confidence scores when matching the document. Okay. So what this agent's main purpose is to try to find the right query to surface the right document.
Okay.
And we still rely on these document scores from our vector database to see how good is the match between the source question and the response.
Okay.
And there's a lot of, and not sure if you want to dive into that, but there's a lot of smart ways that you can embed your knowledge in order to find the right knowledge at the right time. But we employ a lot of those mechanisms. And then in the end, like we still get, like we would with like just a single semantic search step, we still get these confidence scores that we can still compare.
Okay. And then I am curious, it sounds like the knowledge-based data is coming from your customer's website. So are you...
Amongst others, yes.
Okay, so they are able to give you, if they have structured data, they'll give that to you. And then if they don't, or even in addition to that, you're going to go crawl their website.
Exactly.
Like, one thing I'm curious about is when you're setting up, like, the embeddings database for them, are you determining, based on the data that you get, like, your embedding strategy? Are you finding the same embedding strategy works across all your customers? Like, how customized is this knowledge base based on your customers' data?
The embedding strategy is semi-structured.
Okay.
In the sense that we tend to embed based on the document type.
Okay.
So I think one of the best examples is, let's look at an FAQ.
Yeah.
An FAQ is a question and an answer. If you embed the question plus the answer, but your customer asks you just a question, then you will get an okay score. But for an FAQ in general, like the highest match you're ever going to get is if you're embedding only the question and you're retrieving either the question plus the answer or solely the answer. And so for various document types, like for example, for product feeds, we know that semantic search doesn't work too well and keyword search works a lot better. And that is where these various document types that we have defined come in.
Okay.
Where we can say, okay, this is a customer can just upload it and can say, okay, this is an FAQ document. And then we know to embed it in a certain way and to find the questions, embed those, and match in the right way.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. So you're relying on each technology's strengths. You're basically saying, if I have a structured product feed, it has SKUs, it has titles, it has descriptions. Like, I know that's where keyword search excels, so we're going to rely on that. And even with your embeddings, you're embedding just a question and having another way to retrieve the answer so that you get that perfect match. Is that agent also, does it have workflow components, like it's first checking? Like, how does it, when you give it a source question, how does it know what type of document to search?
I wouldn't be able to tell you. It's a large language model. But
okay. So it really is agentic, like the LLM is deciding.
Correct. So of course, like we have this mapping where we explain what an FAQ question is, where we explain what a product feed question is. But from then on out, it's just the agent.
Amazing. Okay. Ah, see, what's so great about this is this feels like a very unstructured problem. Like, sure, there's some structure to it. You're getting product feeds, but crawling a website and like trying to figure out how to dump all this data into a database that is going to be useful. It sounds like there's been a lot of work that has gone into this, and I can see why. Feels like a very critical step.
Yes.
Let's get into evals. I imagine you're replying to emails, so latency isn't your biggest concern, which allows you to put some evals in your production line. Tell me about your thinking. Like, when do you decide to add an eval? At what? Are there evals at each workflow step? Are there evals for each tool? Give me some insights into your eval strategy.
The most important evals in the end we discovered. Like, everyone has chatted with a large language model, and the large language model being like, okay, I can't help you with that. That's not a valid customer support reply.
Yeah.
So, for example, one of our evals is purely checking, do we refuse to answer? If yes, we always send it as an internal note. And the most important things, and that's also what Saina touched upon, is we really had to check with our customers, okay, what's going well, what's going wrong, what would you be confident automating? And one of the most important evals that we have is our hallucination detection. Everyone that has ever interacted with a large language model has seen that they hallucinate. We use a large language model in a weird way, in the sense that if the question would be, where's the Eiffel Tower? I would want it to say, I don't know. unless we explicitly give that context, that piece of information in its knowledge. So that makes our retrieval step even more important. We don't want it to use previous knowledge, while large language models are really trained to have this gigantic brain full with previous knowledge. And it's really annoying to us. Like, it makes it amazing and it makes it brilliant, but it makes it also really annoying. So one of the most important steps that we have is this hallucination detection, where we say, okay, is every single thing you say grounded in our knowledge? And then our knowledge can be false, and then users can find that and users can edit that. But is every single thing that you're saying grounded there? And that is pretty much all of our evals currently run. So we have some offline evals to make sure that our agentic reg works. We have some offline evals that make sure that our evals work. But the evals that we have, they are placed pretty much just before sending out the response to decide whether to provide it as an internal node or whether to directly send it to a customer.
And if any of those evals fail, it gets sent as a suggestion instead of to the end customer? Is there any attempt to like correct for it?
Not currently.
Not currently. Okay.
No.
Interesting. Okay. So you are doing, it sounds like you do have evals for some of your really important steps, like that RAG step. And that's all happening offline. That's just part of your like quality process. But in production, you don't want to, you're really trying to guarantee we're not sending an email to an end customer that includes a hallucination. And I can imagine those are just taking each statement in an email and making sure you can tie it to a source document.
That's it.
Yeah, this is, I love it. I love, it's funny, I'm fairly new to this world. I started building my first AI product like in March of this year, but I dove deep, and it's because it's just so fun to see what people are doing and like being able to wrap our heads around how do we get reliable feedback from a non-deterministic system. And your comment about LLMs want to use all their training data and you don't want them to use their training data. And I've encountered this exact problem of, no, you're limited to this source document. It's really hard. And I can imagine you had to put a lot of work into those evals to make sure that you got them just right.
Exactly. Yes. Unfortunately, yes.
Is there anything you want to share? I know we dove deep on suggestions and responding to support emails. Is there anything notable you want to share about, I think you actions came next, and then I forget what the order of sequence was, but I believe there's four different elements.
Yeah. So yeah, from suggestions went to automation, to the actions within customer support, and then also to actions and workflows beyond customer support as well. So what we saw a lot, and this is also one of the evals, is there an action required or not? And we, of course, only automate tickets if there is either an action required and we did perform it, or if there isn't one, then we won't. And yeah, what we really saw with our customers as well is that automation is great and it's a great next step, but the action piece and actually having the ability to do things on behalf beyond just writing a generic response really is what makes a difference for our customers and really is what actually removes the workload also. I know, I think in the most simple explanation for a CS use case, let's say an email comes in, the customer says, hey, I need to change my order address because I moved, for example. The agent would have to go, like the human agent would have to go and first check, okay, when was the order placed? Is it still in the place where I can change the address? Then probably go to a different system and go ahead and change the address and then go back to the support tool and actually respond to the customer and say, hey, I've done this for you. Here's your confirmation. See you next time. And all of those steps are very straightforward. They're very easy to also to explain to, in our case, in Nepal. It's just, okay, if X, then do A, then do B, then do C. And yeah, really bring those pieces together and also enabling customers to actually teach an EPL in a conversational way is what really made a difference for us there. So our customers are not sitting there necessarily with a workflow builder moving step A and B around, but they are explaining it like they would explain it also to their colleague. So if someone new was onboarding, they would also probably have a session where they say, hey, this is how we do this process. And we are doing exactly the same thing in the product. So customers can just chat with their NEPO and explain in their terms how a process works. The NEPO digests that information, learns from it, proposes how it would do the thing, and the customer is enabled to see how it learned, what the guardrails are that it took and tested to really also there build the confidence to.
Okay, help me understand what's the difference between an automation and an action.
Yeah, so an automation, how we define that's mainly due to our customer base, is just responding to a ticket automatically. So rather than providing a suggestion. Yeah. Okay. And then an action is actually doing something in the system beyond to be able to automate the ticket. Yeah.
And I imagine to support actions, you're giving the agent access to tools that allows them to do those actions.
Exactly.
Okay, so one thing you just said that I love this idea of I can just have a conversation and explain to my NEPO like I would explain to a colleague how to do a new process. But as someone who has tried to automate a lot of things with generative AI, it never works the first time. And so I'm curious about this like loop you go through with non-technical customers to make these actions reliable.
Yeah, it is definitely a journey, I would say. And it's definitely also been a learning journey to really understand what is the right method to bring customers close to it and really make it actually accessible. And one big aspect that we learned there is templates and templating as much as possible. A lot of our customers are in similar areas, so their workflows do heavily overlap. There is that 20% of customization, but the 80% of the like general flow is often the same. So we provide them with a lot of templates that they can use and just customize them and explain to people what they wanted to do differently. And what we also really optimize for with our customers is to really start small with step-by-step processes rather than trying to, for example, automate their whole order cancellation flow in one go. If you think about canceling an order in e-commerce, there is usually at least 40 different edge cases that you need to take into account, depending on who the order is from, when it was placed, when the delivery date is, for example. And there are so many edge cases to be taken into account. If you try to solve all of them at the same time, you're going to end up, at least on the backend side of things, with a huge decision tree that the NEPO is going to have to go through and check every single step. So we really look at the concrete workflows, specific workflows with our customers, and guide them to start with those rather than trying to automate the whole thing. And that really helps to increase that first time write rates and getting them to that value quickly.
This is such an underrated skill when working with AI. I can imagine like you could say, okay, we're going to start to chip away at when someone cancels an order. And we're going to say, we're only going to handle the cancellations where the product hasn't shipped. That's like our easiest case. And so if a support ticket comes in, it has to do with cancellations, your agent knows to not automatically respond unless it's for a use case where there is an action. And if there's no action that covers it, it gets triggered as a suggestion. Is that right? Okay.
Exactly.
So you're training your customers how to like iteratively chip away at these complex use cases.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like we have some customers that when they first start looking at really doing actions, they come to us with a 50-page manual on what their order cancellation process is. And I've read through many of these documents and I don't even necessarily always understand what it is exactly that they're trying to achieve and what the edge cases are that they're trying to account for in these documents. And by really guiding them into that step-by-step layer, it has also really changed also the way our customers look at their problems to solve, because they also start looking at, okay, what is the actual problem I'm trying to solve here? Rather than what are the 20 edge cases I'm also trying to cover in the same breath.
You're teaching your customers decomposition, which is mind-blowing to me. And you're doing this via a conversational interface. Walk me through how this works. Do I write in the conversational interface, I want to automate cancellations, and then it just helps me like scope the work?
For example, is one way to do it, yes. So okay. You could just literally be like, hey, I want to automate this flow, let's say canceling orders. And then NEPO will start asking follow-up questions to understand, okay, what is it exactly that you're trying to do? And it will basically look at, okay, what are the pieces of information I need to actually successfully complete that flow? So we have a multi-step, like multi-step logic in there that the Meeple knows, and it will ask the right questions to really understand, okay, what system are you using? What conditions can I do this by? What's my trigger? Like, when do I know that I need to cancel an order? And then that could be, for example, a relevant ticket comes in. What do I need to consider from a guardrails perspective? Is there anything such as, okay, if an order is over 700 euros, I can't cancel it? And then, yeah, step by step, you're conversating with your Meeple and putting together the pieces until you feel confident, okay, it has all of that relevant info. And you can straight away go ahead and test it yourself and see what it does, step by step, change it, tell it again to do it differently, but really in a way that's actually, I think understandable for most non-technical people.
Okay, I think I had an aha moment when you were explaining that. Your Meeple is using the template, not your end customer. Is that right?
Yeah, your Meeple is using the template, and the customer can choose from the template.
Yeah, because I was wondering, like, if this is just a conversational interface, like, where do templates come into play? But I'm assuming the template guides what questions the Meeple asks the customer.
So the way that the templates work is that the customer will have an overview of the workflow that comes out of it, not in a kind of like step-by-step workflow builder way, but in a conversational matter as well. So with like its bubbles of the different conditions, exactly. Yeah. And okay, this is what I'm using as my trigger. These are my conditions. These are my rules, all of those things. And so those we have templated for the like major use cases.
Okay.
And then you will start building on top of that. So if you use a template, you need both, for example, ask, okay, what systems are you using? Because those are not in the template. It's just the process in the template. Are there any other guardrails you specifically are doing? So it's more the output is templated. Yeah.
Okay. So the customer is aware of the templates. It's like these canned use cases they start from. And then the AI is using the template to guide the discovery of what do I need to learn to be able to create this workflow or this action.
Exactly that.
That is so cool. We could have spent a whole hour just digging into how that agent works, but we're going to run out of time, so we're not going to do that. What is next for your team?
Yeah, what is next for our team? So obviously with all of the things we just mentioned, especially in regards to actions and actions beyond CS, there is a lot of opportunities that we're currently digging in there. What we are seeing with our customers is that autonomy that we've started to build with them and that kind of trust in AI is really motivating them to go beyond their regular horizon per se and really start also bringing people into their organizations. So our focus is really on enabling our customers to do beyond the CS use case. And also, of course, in the context of the continuous improvements in the world of AI, always looking at, okay, what are the next things that we are also going to be bringing into the product to enable our customers to do so even better. I think we're in quite a good place when it comes to all of the like repetitive workflows and the really standard workflows and are now also starting to look at, okay, how do we actually enable our customers better on complex workflows as well? Might not be the full end-to-end automation and action execution, because oftentimes they do require a layer of reasoning, but there are still a lot of ways that we're currently discovering with our customers on enabling them better to be more successful or faster in those workflows as well.
Yeah, I can see so many areas where you could expand based on. It seems like you have a few really cool assets for helping an organization adopt AI around this idea of you have a conversational interface to help you build workflows and define actions for your company. We've got a set of templates that makes that easy to use. What's nice about customer support tickets is there's a trigger, right? There's something that hangs all this on. As you look at like other functions in the business and they're like looking to expand, are you starting to identify what those other triggers are? And if you can, I'd love to hear about them. If you can't, that's fine too. I'm just curious about, are you seeing an analogy there, or is it you really have to rethink for each function how to start this off?
Yeah, I think it differs quite a bit per function. I think CS is the most consistent one for sure. I would say there's quite a lot of parallels in companies with, for example, monthly or weekly kind of workflows that they need to trigger. So then there is a trigger point at least. Or if you look at more commercial roles, there's often a meeting or an email that can be utilized as a trigger point as well. But there are quite a few areas where we really need to also look with our customers and their expanded use cases. What actually are useful triggers? Because a lot of those workflows oftentimes are ad hoc and more on a, like, when I need it and then I really need it.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to need it every day. If you think beyond CS and operations, most roles do have some form of repetitive work, but it usually looks different to the really like everyday repetitive work. And so then it's really about finding those use cases and also looking at how can we combine the flexibility that's often needed for those, because maybe people are on different projects at different times. So you actually need different input for your repetitive workflow still, and making that very easy for customers to work with, while balancing, of course, with those really repetitive tasks as well.
Yeah, I could imagine. I know there's already a ton of like digital sales agents, but like inbound leads could be a trigger. Yeah. Finance clearly has a cadence. Even product teams have a cadence. I feel like there's so much.
Definitely.
What's fun about your space is that you really could go in almost any direction. I think that's also what's challenging about your space, is how do you have the discipline to make sure what you're doing is really, you maintain that quality.
That's definitely, I think, ever recurring topic and something that we're also always very aware of, because going broad doesn't necessarily equal better, depending on how you approach it. And I would say we're very happy that also the niche that we started out in customer success and customer service is really our niche that we also really perfected. And that also gives us the flexibility to go beyond. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Okay, so for folks who are listening, if they want to learn more about getting a Neeple, where do they go?
Yeah, best to find us on our neeple.io. Lots of information on there. Also a bit of an update coming in the coming time period as well to the website. So yeah, you can definitely check us out there. And you can also find us on the Joy Lab, where we host also our own podcast and also do a lot of AI-related topics as well. Yop posts a lot there as well, so you can also find us there.
I just subscribed to the Joy Lab right before we started recording. I'm very excited. It looked amazing. Are your customers global or primarily based in Europe?
Primarily based in Europe with some US customers as well, and also customers operating on a global scale as well.
Okay, so not limited to Europe?
No, definitely not limited.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, all three of you. This has been spectacular. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having us. It's been a great time.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe in your favorite podcast app and give us a rating, as it helps others find the show. Thanks. I appreciate it.